Welcome to episode 33 of the Steptoe of Cyber Law podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government, and I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in our New York office. Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe, and returning as our guest commentator, I think maybe our first repeat guest, is computer crime guru Oren Kerr. Oren is a professor of law at George Washington University, a scholar on computer crime law and internet surveillance, and the indispensable citation in any such case in front of a federal district court, or a court of appeals for that matter. I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, holding the record for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. We just had somebody else come back who used to be head of the firm, Lon Bocknight, who's only one behind me, but he is also older than me. So I'm hoping that I'm going to hold on to this record. He'd have to leave and come back twice before he turned 75 to beat me out. So let's get started on the news in the week. This week in NSA, actually, there's a fair amount. If you read it broadly, but almost none of the news stories that are interesting are news stories that Glenn Greenwald or his Snowdenistas would have picked as stories they wanted to see in the news. The most obvious of those is the controversy in which several government and former government officials have attributed to Snowden some of the improvements in ISIS's this is the terror group that controls big chunks of territory in Syria and Iraq. Their security, it turns out, is very good. As we know, we sent the special forces in to rescue some of the hostages who were later killed, but couldn't find them. I think Chris Inglis, who's been on the show, said it's clearly the case that ISIS has learned from the Snowden leaks. And there's at least one story that described in detail how the government was able to get access to some ISIS communications because ISIS had thought at the time that it was clever to leave a draft of this, of their correspondence on Gmail and just keep editing the draft, a technique that seems to be remarkably popular with people who don't know how NSA actually works. I am quite confident that once the New York Times published that fact, ISIS stopped doing it, probably beheaded the guys who had been doing it. And so the idea that Snowden's leaks had nothing to do with our problems against ISIS strike me as implausible, but there nonetheless are any number of Snowdenista journalists who insist that that can't possibly be true because Snowden's a hero. Other stories on NSA, I thought it was kind of mildly interesting. This wasn't a big surprise, but Justice and DNI have, and the Office of the DNI have announced that they support Senator Leahy's USA Freedom Bill. This was pretty obvious from the signals the administration was sending, but they've now written it down. It might be arguably significant that NSA actually didn't join that letter, although you could argue that DNI speaks for them on this. My sense is that NSA is deeply unenthusiastic about Senator Leahy's USA Freedom Bill, but has been told to sit down and shut up. And considering their current status at the White House, that's probably good advice for them. Other than that, I mean, I think this gives the USA Freedom Bill that Leahy's produced more legs, but probably not enough, in my view, in the next 14 days, which is all there is before the election, as far as Congress is going, not enough to get it onto the agenda and passed. It's not the same bill as the bill that the House passed, so it either has to be pre-conferenced or conferenced, and so you have to have agreement with the House, which is hard to get since the membership is pretty unruly on this issue, but, and so, maybe it could get to the floor, maybe it could be adopted, the likelihood that the House would then recede is small. There'd have to be some negotiation. None of that. There's no reason for them to do this. They don't have to have a substitute for the 215 program until the middle of 2015, and my guess is they'll kick it. So that's the latest on that. The last thing that I thought was interesting, and again, kind of happened over the weekend, was we got to see a less redacted version of Jack Goldsmith's OLC opinion. This is the one that said that the precursor to the 215 program was legal. And I don't know how many of you guys got a chance to look at that. I thought it was pretty interesting, and surprisingly, it's long and still redacted in some respects, but surprisingly persuasive. I had thought that it would be very hard, given the fact that FISA says this is the only way you can conduct wiretaps in the United States for national security purposes. Period. Full stop. It would be pretty hard to say, yes, we have another way of doing it, and it involves just the president saying so. But the argument seemed to be, look, we're at war with Al-Qaeda. We are trying to intercept Al-Qaeda's communications, and every war we've ever fought that has had electronic communications in it, we have intercepted the enemy's communications without any specific, particularly specific authority. If you need authority, look at the authorization for the use of military force. So from thinking that this was hard to justify, I now think it's, especially in the weeks after 9/11, actually surprisingly justifiable. And maybe we don't want a world where no matter what happens, the president is unable to do anything except pursue things under FISA. Did you take a look at that, Oren?
I skimmed it and read those parts. I mean, I was surprised that Goldsmith had relied on the Article 2 arguments as a backup. Maybe you had to do that at OLC.
This is OLC. Of course he relied on it.
I guess that's right. I've never worked at OLC. Maybe that's just what people do.
I think they have a macro for that.
but it struck me as not that far from the arguments that, you know, were widely criticized, generally associated with John Yoo and the like, but it was sort of a softer version as a backup instead of the lead argument, but basically the same sort of claim. I mean, it seems to me that the argument that sort of in an earlier day, the U.S. government had done this, it tells you some things, but of course leaves out a lot of other things. You know, the idea that the Fourth Amendment would apply to that sort of surveillance was not plausible until right. The 1960s. And then of course it was before FISA existed as a statute. So I think what I find interesting is going forward, now everyone's on notice that these arguments are out there. So to the extent Congress is worried about particular kinds of surveillance, they can say, okay, we know you're going to rely on Article 2. We know you're going to rely on the AUMF.
And they reject them.
They can take preemptive steps and you can have sort of the branches of government working in somewhat of an effective way to respond to those known interpretations. What I always was struck by is the idea that, you know, I don't think Congress was aware of these interpretations at the time, or at least members of the public trying to get a sense of what the government was doing. Weren't aware of it. So it's the surprise that matters maybe.
Although
more than
I think
the interpretation.
When they passed FISA, they knew quite well that there were arguments because, of course, all national security wiretaps have been conducted on that authority. And they said, well, to make sure that argument never works again, we are going to say right here in print, you may not rely on anything except this law. And, it turns out that precatory language. It's kind of that's like the preamble to legislation. You know, nice to know, but not necessarily binding. and I guess I would say It is also the case that in the run-up to World War II, the administration directly and deliberately violated an anti-wiretapping law that had been interpreted as applying to espionage inside the United States. The FCC, the Communications Act of 34, said, you know, you can't intercept radio communications. And for a long time, the Defense Department, or the War Department, I guess, said, okay, well, so we're not allowed to do that. We can't listen in to the Japanese embassy's communications. And then, like around 1939, when war was quite imminent, there was a decision by the government that they were just going to start collecting it, notwithstanding what the Communications Act of 34 said. In fact, I think it was General Marshall who made that determination. And so there's a long history.
I think there was at least one important textual difference, though. This is going back, you know, the history of the Communications Act, but the prohibitions in that law was against interception and disclosure. And I guess it was then Attorney General Robert Jackson who interpreted that to mean wiretapping was okay as long as they didn't use it in court. So that was sort of the green light, which of course J. Edgar Hoover uses takes to the nth degree. So there was at least a textual argument that struck me as kind of more plausible than some of the other arguments.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Any thoughts from the rest of our panel here? You guys don't want to weigh in on this. You don't want to put at risk your future confirmation. all right, so let's turn on to private law. I thought that was kind of at a time when everybody is complaining that Google searches might, you know, occasionally favor some Google properties, and that's viewed as shocking. We got a decision from a district court that more or less said, in the context of Yelp, you know, I don't care whether they're taking money to suppress search results. It's their website, and they can do with it what they want. Or at least that's how I read it. Michael, I know you looked more closely at the case.
I did. It's actually it was actually the Ninth Circuit affirming a district court decision. And you know, I thought this was a pretty weak case because I thought the plaintiff's lawyers' legal theories weren't that strong. But that's not to say I think that someone couldn't come up with a better argument. I mean, basically what they argued was that Yelp was violating the California unfair competition law by manipulating reviews for small businesses, so that if a small business paid for advertising on Yelp, then favorable reviews would be published on Yelp and perhaps negative ones would be suppressed. And if somebody didn't pay for advertising, then the negative ones would get more attention, or at least they wouldn't be suppressed. But under the unfair competition law, you've got to show either that the conduct was unlawful under some other law or that it was somehow unfair. And the plaintiff's theory was that it was unlawful because essentially this amounted to extortion, which seemed like a pretty outlandish claim, and also that it amounted to an antitrust violation. So those seem like rather flimsy bases for me, at least, to bring a UCL claim. I mean, I could think of a simpler argument that this is tortious interference with prospective customer relations. You know, it's Yelp's site, but on the other hand, you can't just say anything on your site without consequence. I mean, there's, you know, defamation law can apply in some situations and things like that. So I wouldn't write off a future suit like this succeeding in the future.
Yeah, well, I you know, it occurred to me that if they had brought this case in Europe, they could have said, well, Yelp is not allowing us a right to have our bad reviews forgotten, and we've got a whole bunch of reviews that we think are inadequate or irrelevant or outdated, and we want them all suppressed under European law, and that would at least be plausible as a claim. I've been ridden by the right to be forgotten because I spent a chunk of the weekend looking through the results of my effort to hack the Google right to be forgotten procedures. You may remember I actually filed several requests, the favorite of which was that they take down a TechDirt page, which is apparently devoted to blackening my character, right? I said, well, this is a discussion of my political views, which is sensitive personal information, and it's wrong. And these guys are just doing it to make money. So my interest in having my views properly represented totally trumps their interest in making money off of criticism of them. I thought, well, you know, as a parody of European law, at least this was plausible. The Google did not agree and refused to take it down. I thought what was most interesting, you can read the whole thing, but what was most interesting is that they decided to actually rule on this, because I was afraid they were going to refused on the ground that I sent them a Virginia driver's license to prove my identity. I wasn't a European. I didn't get to pursue claims under European law. But that's a misunderstanding of European law. European law is a grand rights of man thing, and it is the European mission to bring the light of proper understanding of data protection to the rest of the lightless world. Google has evidently been forced to conclude that it has to rule on takedown requests only for European search engines, but from anyone in the world, which means that there is, and for those of you who are listening to this, who are unemployed, you lawyers graduating in the last 5 years, this is your chance to get in on a brand new area of law, which is filing right to be forgotten requests on behalf of non-Europeans with Google and Bing, because you know, there are plenty of people with money who really regret one silly article and who will never forget it and who will cheerfully pay you to file these requests. So by agreeing to answer mine, I think they have opened up a vast new area of controversy for themselves at Google. So that's I don't know if you guys have any further views. I know Oren always reads my posts.
They haven't officially said that they're going to extend this right to non-EU persons, right? I mean, I thought that they were initially limiting it and that the EU really, despite its grand theory of the expansiveness of its law, really wasn't going to apply it to non-Europeans. So maybe this is just Google saying it's administratively easier not to look at the residency of the people making a complaint. Or else they're just trying to generate more and more opposition to the right to be forgotten. So if they can get Americans,
That could be. And what better way to do it than to respond to my requests? They should have granted them. That really would have been outrageous. I haven't seen an official statement on either side of this from Google. And this is one of the reasons I did this Google hacking exercise, is to try to figure out what the rules are. I mean, this is a government censorship program delegated to a private company under threat of massive liability. And so the only way you're going to find out how the government censorship program works is to start submitting requests and see what the government, what the search engines do with it.
It's a very strange for the EU and for Google not to have stated something explicitly, since it's an obvious question and it's a rather fundamental one, is, you know, about whether this applies to non-EU persons.
EU law clearly applies to non-EU persons. The only question is whether you're doing the processing of the data in Europe or exporting it from Europe. So they would say if the data passes through Europe in any fashion before it ends up in the search engine, we have some jurisdiction here, right? That's what I think. And certainly if you...
I can't recall who and in what context, but there have been statements by EU officials to the contrary. I'll try to dig them up for next week.
Yeah, that would be good. But in any event, it looks as though, since there was not even a hint from Google that they were treating this in any way other than on the merits, I think it's fair to assume that if you make a request, even if you're from Saudi Arabia or Japan, they will take it down applying European law.
Yeah, and you know, and this comes back to a question we discussed last week, which is I don't know what the rationale is for confining this to Google's EU sites and not Google.com, which is also accessible in Europe.
It is accessible. I guess the argument would be, I think, that the ads are not tailored to the jurisdiction, and therefore it's not clear that they, unless they are actually gathering the information exclusively in some German location, that there's jurisdiction because there isn't an obvious nexus between anything that Google does and the search results in the jurisdiction concerned and the search results on Google.com. I think that's a, you know, it's a close call. If I were advising Google on this, I'm not sure I would say you're home free. On the other hand, if they were to try to, they're basically then censoring what Americans can read because it offends French sensibilities. You know, that's a pretty substantial intrusion into our sovereignty, it seems to me.
But since when did that bother them?
Ah, no, that's right. I think I said on the last show that I thought the government ought to weigh in and consider foreign agent registration requirements, saying, you know, if you're denying information to Americans based on policies and directions of foreign governments, you may not be a voluntary foreign agent, but you sure as hell are a foreign agent, and we want you to disclose that fact. What do they say? If you've got three stories, it's a trend.
Right.
So we've got Baidu, which defended its unwillingness to tell anybody what happened at Tiananmen Square in 89 on the grounds that they had a First Amendment right to suppress that information at the direction of the government of China. We've got this Google thing. And then just this last week, LinkedIn disclosed that they're doing business in China now. They censor their Chinese site. But if Chinese subscribers post things that the Chinese government doesn't like, LinkedIn won't disclose those things in the United States either.
That's right. It's a great segue from your observation about the French that, you know, you have censorship of content in the U.S. in response to a foreign government. So the controversy came about because LinkedIn, as you probably know, has been doing business in China since February and announced at the time that they started doing business in China that they anticipated they were going to have to restrict access to some content at the request of the Chinese government. And in fact, within a few months of going online with LinkedIn's Chinese site, they got a list of topics, which they haven't disclosed, from the Chinese government saying that these topics were restricted. So very recently, LinkedIn sent an email to a journalist who had written an article about the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, notifying him that his post was blocked in China, and the journalist then released the email. And apparently an Australian journalist received a similar notice. That in itself was not surprising, that, you know, the Chinese government censoring articles about Tiananmen Square in China. What was more surprising is, as you said in the lead-in, that LinkedIn's applying that policy in such a way that the content is not only unavailable in China, but it's unavailable anywhere else either. LinkedIn says the policy is intended to protect Chinese dissidents from retaliation. If the Chinese government sees the content posted in some other country's site, then they can retaliate against the folks in country.
They could just send them an email saying, we've been told not to post this. You sure you want us to post it outside China?
That's right.
And let the subscriber take the risk.
And I wouldn't be surprised if that's the direction it goes. LinkedIn, in response to the public backlash that this journalist released the emails generated, they're reviewing the policy. So I wouldn't be surprised if the policy got tweaked just a little bit, and probably something along the lines of what you suggested, where the poster takes responsibility for knowing that the post is going to be available in some fashion outside the country.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the flip side of soft power. This is foreign soft power exercised in the United States to shape our view of the world, and not the first and not the last. But We ought to have some kind of tools for dealing with this. And since all we've got right now is the Foreign Agent Registration Act, I'm trying to figure out whether there's a way to twist it into an authority to at least require people to disclose, yes, indeed, I am under direction, and yes, indeed, these are the topics that I'm not disclosing. And, you know, maybe they can do it in confidence, and then the U.S. government can announce, you know, people have told us this, and so just so you know, these are items that are not available from certain kinds of search engines or what have you. That would be a form of regulation of speech that is actually pro First Amendment. That would be an interesting question, whether you can do that. Well, turning to something a little more directly likely to produce litigation, more breaches. Home Depot looks like had a big breach, perhaps related to some of the Target breaches and others. Senator Rockefeller said, I hope you'll tell me exactly what happened and what you're doing. Jason, does this look like more the same, or is Home Depot going to avoid a complete targetization?
Well, at least they're off to a good start. They're off to a better start than Target. Target is sort of the poster child of how not to handle public notification after a breach, where Target was making public statements before they fully understood the facts and then having to correct those statements over and over again. Home Depot hasn't even confirmed that they've had a breach. They've said that they're investigating the possibility that they've been breached. And all they've said is that if they confirm it, they will let customers know. But they haven't made any statements at any level of detail about what the potential scope is, which is smart. And basically doing everything the opposite of what Target did is in this space tends to be smart.
That's right.
But, you know, they're the latest in a very long and distinguished, increasingly distinguished list of American retailers that have suffered this fate. And I think, you know, we have a combination now of sort of breach report fatigue, where people sort of roll their eyes at yet another breach report. But even more, it's congressional outrage over breach report fatigue.
Yes. You
know, we don't know whether Home Depot's been breached, although when Brian Krebs says you've been breached, you've been breached. And, and so odds are that they have. We don't know, assuming they haven't been breached, whether it's in fact related to the same malware that was used in Target and the other retailers, although, the Secret Service and DHS issued a warning to retailers back in earlier in the summer to look for this kind of malware, and it was around the time that this breach was taking place. But what was most predictable about this is the reaction on the Hill, which is more noise and more outrage and no indication of any action. So after Target got breached, and then especially after Neiman Marcus and Michaels followed in close succession, it seemed like everybody in the Senate was sponsoring or co-sponsoring a data breach related bill.
Right.
And some of them included federal breach notification standards. Some of them included more powers, God forbid, for the FTC. Very few focused on empowering victim companies or empowering the Justice Department to go after hackers with more resources. But no action. Just everybody sponsored a bill, told the public they were sponsoring a bill, and then none of the bills got passed. Senator Rockefeller had a hearing, issued a report on the details of the Target breach and some other breaches. And now in response to the double whammy of Home Depot and the nude celebrity selfies that were hacked from iCloud, has indicated that he's going to collect more information.
I didn't see that he sent Kate Upton a letter saying, what the hell are you doing about this breach, damn it?
I don't think he's asked any of the celebrities why they posted the pictures on iCloud, but he's asked Apple for information about how they might have gotten stolen. And he's asked Home Depot for information too. It's hard to see why this breach would be the straw that breaks the camel's back and actually spurs Congress to pass a bill.
Well, especially since those 14 days are as long as Senator Rockefeller is going to be in the Senate.
That's right. So there's not much going on there. You know, in the meantime, the credit card industry is trying to take its own steps to address the security payment systems.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I mean, this is not chip and pin. They're moving past that, and this makes sense. although it's not really a response. It's not a good answer, or not a complete answer to cyber insecurity, because it's mostly about saying of the stores saying, I don't want to be liable for this anymore, so keep this information away from me.
Yeah.
It's sort of like you know, to some extent, Microsoft's response to the cybersecurity problems is, now you get a box that said, this is a dangerous thing to do. You're sure you want to do it? Because it's your responsibility now, right?
Right.
Not ours. And the more the proliferation of those boxes has lots of good legal justification, but it doesn't do much for cybersecurity.
No, and in fact, and it's not exclusive with chip and PIN. I mean, there's still, I think people are expecting hundreds of millions of chip and PIN cards to be issued over the next year or so, which will at least help with a little bit with brick and mortar stores.
Uh-huh.
But, observers in Europe have said that when chip and PIN began being widely adopted in Europe, the hackers moved to online sales.
Which we've already moved to here.
So this tokenization would help a little bit with online sales and could help to some degree with brick and mortar stores. But all that means is that the data is being moved from the merchant server to the payment processor and the card issuer server. So that's where the hackers are going to go.
Well, and they haven't gone there because those are probably harder targets than the easier of the merchants. But I think, Visa and MasterCard could end up regretting this because all the fraud and all the attacks will move to them.
That's right.
And if you can't even air gap your way to security for a centrifuge system in Iran, the likelihood that they can keep their big mainframes safe from attacks strikes me as modest at best.
I think that's right. And I think that, as you said, they will become the focus of the attack. All the liability will be directed at them. And they're a harder target, but they're not an impossible one. There's no such thing as an impossible one. And so it's only a matter of time before, whether it's an air gap or some other system they have, before there's a breach. And then all the eyes are squarely focused on the card issuers.
Well, and then, a lot of these hacks get caught, or at least the consequences get mitigated, because those big mainframes, which haven't been breached, can do pattern recognition, can stop payments on certain kinds of transactions. If somebody ever breaks into those, they're going to start authorizing those things and taking the holds off of cards and spending more money. It's going to get really ugly.
That's right. In fact, some of the worst breaches that we investigated when I was at the department involved breaches of payment processors, where the hackers would – this happened with the Royal Bank of Scotland. The case was prosecuted in Atlanta, where the hackers actually broke into the payment processor's computer system and were able to trick the computer into – repopulating the account after it was drawn down. So they only breached about 40 or 45 payment card accounts, but they got $9 or $10 million.
Wow.
Because once the account was drawn down, they just put more artificial money back in it, and the computer thought that the withdrawal limits didn't apply, and the computer thought that the account had been replenished.
Oh yeah, this is the one where people just stood there kind of with the money pouring out of the ATM until it was gone. Yeah,
2,800 ATM withdrawals in 12 hours all over the world, and it was all from the same 40 or 45 accounts. So those are pretty attractive targets to hackers.
So the other hack that got some play was the healthcare.gov hack. Michael, did you take a close look at that?
Yeah, I think there's less there than meets the eye, and I think it got a lot of play only because it's healthcare.gov, and Republicans have run out of ways to criticize the program since it's proven to be wildly successful. Apparently, at least according to what the administration has said, what was hacked was a test server, had no personal information on it, and it was not hacked in order to get personal information, but in order to turn it into part of a botnet to engage in denials of service against other computers. So, who knows? Maybe this will turn out to be more, but according to initial information, this is really not a big deal.
Yeah, it sounds as though there was a stray computer that wasn't hooked up to the network and was hooked up to the internet by mistake, and the hackers found it and infected it so that they could call on it to send an occasional DDoS message. That's a long way, and it is a hack, but it doesn't mean you got access to the healthcare.gov records. Yeah, I think that is that. I'm not sure I would describe the Obamacare as wildly successful, but I certainly agree with you that this sounds like it's been hyped. Last topic that I wanted to touch on is this case in New York that seems to have thrown off all kinds of computer law decisions, Fourth Amendment decisions and anonymity decisions. This is a Hasidic child abuse case, if I understand it, and it all turns on the trial at which the victim testified and her picture then showed up online. And in the effort to figure out what happened, New York is making all kinds of law. I don't know, Jason, whether you looked closely at that, but it was remarkable.
I did. It's a hell of a story, and Oren could do a whole class just based on the legal issues from this one case. If Law and Order were still on the air, this would almost certainly be next week's episode. That they always seem to rip stories from the headlines, and this one has plenty of twists and turns to it. So, as a little bit of backstory, so there's a Hasidic man who was on trial in 2012 for child sex abuse in New York State Court in Brooklyn. He was ultimately convicted and sentenced to 50 years in jail. During the trial, he had a young female victim, and she testified, now grown up. She testified against him. And the judge had warned the members of the gallery not to use their cell phones in the courtroom and reminded them that there was a courthouse rule against taking pictures of any kind in the courthouse. And a man named Weissman, who was in the gallery, allegedly took and posted online through a Twitter account a photo of the victim while she was testifying. And a court security officer had seen Weissman with his cell phone during the trial, told him to put it away, which he did. Later on, another court security officer saw Weissman in the hallway, thought that Weissman had taken a picture of the officer, and which would itself violate the courthouse rules. And so he asked to see Weissman's cell phone, asked Weissman to show him, or directed him to show him all his photos. There was, in fact, no photo of the officer, but the officer kept scrolling anyway, and he found a photo of the victim on the stand. And there was evidence that that photo had been posted to Twitter. So Weissman was prosecuted criminally for contempt, along with two other people, a guy named Joseph Reed and a person whose not given but legal name is Lemon Juice, who was actually...
His legal name is Lemon Juice.
Yeah, his mother didn't name him Lemon Juice, but he went to court to get it changed.
All right.
And he was there as a friend of the victim. So Lemon Juice and Weissman and this other third guy were all prosecuted for criminal contempt. Weissman's case spawned one interesting piece of law, and Lemon Juice has spawned another. So in Weissman's case, the judge who was presiding over Weissman's criminal contempt case suppressed all the evidence from the search of the cell phone under the Supreme Court's decision in Riley because it was a search of a cell phone without a warrant. The judge noted that there was a diminished expectation of privacy in the courthouse and that permitted the officer to seize the phone and perhaps even to do an initial review of the photos on the phone to see if there was a photo of the officer. But the officer didn't stop there and actually scrolled, or either scrolled through himself or directed Weissman to scroll through the rest of the photos.
So was this a post-Riley search?
This was a pre-Riley search.
So they didn't grant them a good faith of exception.
No, they didn't. Okay. I mean, the search took place 2 years before the decision of Riley. So once the court had, the court basically said that effectively a search took place because the officer forced the owner of the phone to display its contents without a warrant. And so that evidence was suppressed, and that effectively undermined the criminal case against Weissman because the evidence from the phone was the heart of the case against him. So that would be an interesting enough story. But it's more interesting because of the Lemon Juice angle. So the photo was posted on Twitter. The photo of the victim was posted on Twitter using a Twitter account attributed to this guy Lemon Juice, complete with a Twitter handle that includes the words Lemon Juice and a photo of Mr. Juice on Twitter. Problem is, Mr. Juice says he doesn't have a Twitter account, he's never used Twitter, and that someone impersonated him and set up the account on his name to frame him. Earlier this year, the criminal contempt case against Juice was thrown out. The judge concluded there was no evidence there was sufficient reason to doubt that he had been the one who had actually created the account. And in fact, based on some of the evidence turned over in discovery, Juice's lawyers think they know who actually created the account and impersonated him in posting the photo, and it was a person who is a supporter of the defendant in the underlying child sex abuse story. So you remember Mr. Juice was a friend of the victim, and the person who impersonated Mr. Juice apparently was a supporter of the victim's abuser. So now Juice wants to go after the person who impersonated him and put him through this hell, and so he asked a New York judge to order Twitter to turn over information that would allow him to identify the person who posted the photo and effectively to confirm his suspicions that it was this supporter of the abuser. And the judge last week concluded that the conduct in impersonating this guy and posting the photo under his name was atrocious malice, to use the court's words, and was not protected by the First Amendment, and actually ordered Twitter to turn over the information. And Twitter hasn't formally responded yet, so it's not clear what Twitter's going to do. But you've got a search case that's right on the heels of Riley, and then you've got a First Amendment right to internet anonymity case.
So we got Oren Kerr here, world's greatest computer crime guru. Did the judge get this right in both cases?
Yeah, the Fourth Amendment issue would be the same for a cell phone as it would be for any physical property. So you'd have to ask yourself if the, you know, court security officer sees somebody who he thinks has some contraband or something on him, does he need a warrant to search the person inside the courthouse? I would be kind of skeptical that that's actually required. And you know, Riley's just a question of search incident to arrest. There's no arrest here as far as I know. So,
it's really administrative search.
Administrative search question. Yeah. So I'm not sure that's right, but I'm a little skeptical.
I think the courts are wildly overreading Riley, but we'll see. I mean, you will talk about another case in a second. But yes, well, and so how about the Twitter case? That actually strikes me as pretty easy. You didn't even need to find malice, in my view. You just say this is relevant evidence. This is the only way we're going to get it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that I'm thinking just under the Stored Communications Act, could they force Twitter to disclose it? Twitter has a right to disclose it. So it's their choice.
No, you'd need a court order. I think that's right. But on what basis, other than this soft notion that sometimes anonymity is a nice thing and sometimes it's not, and so you ought to be cautious about it. There have been a lot of cases, where anonymous communications, downloads of music, or abusive statements have resulted in disclosure orders in John Doe cases, right? This is just a John Doe case.
Yeah, and as long as it's non-content information that they're disclosing, it would be something that could be court could order. There's no
That's right. This is
going prohibition to be under the
registration information and maybe the IP address that he used to register. So
right.
he may have set the bar too high, but he got over it anyway.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I'm tempted to say that this is all of the result of bias against the juice, but
how long are you holding on to that one?
Since you started this, fascinating case, and it's deeply politically divisive in the Hasidic community. I gather that's part of the problem.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay. The one other issue that we ought to cover before we start talking to Oren is a couple of regulatory actions that aren't exactly privacy. Google got hit up for allowing kids, what do they call it, friendly fraud, to use their parents' credit cards to make in-app purchases, and Verizon paid $7 million for sending inadequate notices to customers. Michael, I think you probably looked at both of those, didn't you?
I thought the Google settlement was a bigger deal because, well, first of all, it was a pretty heavy fine, $19 million, I think, in which they're going to have to refund parents whose kids made purchases that were unauthorized by the parents. And even if people don't request refunds up to $19 million, the rest of it goes to the federal treasury, which the FTC likes to do, of course, because it boosts their statistics about recovery. But, you know, I think this is something that other sites that have in-app purchases and other companies that you know, benefit from those sorts of purchases are going to have to pay attention to, because they're going to have to put constraints on the ability of people to make those sorts of purchases. The Verizon matter was, you know, Verizon for a few years for certain customers didn't provide the requisite notice that people could opt out of collection of their personal information for the purposes of advertising. And so Verizon got slammed by the FCC and has to pay I think it's a $7 million penalty, and also has to remind people of their opt-out rights in all their bills for the next 3 years, I believe. So that was, I think, an oversight on Verizon's part. Still a pretty heavy fine, but doesn't have the sort of systemic implications that I think the Google settlement with the FTC does.
Yeah, and my guess is on both cases, and this is increasingly seems to be how these are turning out, that the risk of class action liability, which is the only liability anybody worries about besides federal regulatory liability, pretty small in both cases. It's not clear there were damages in the Verizon case. And if you're a parent and you want to say, my kid made in-app purchases, your circumstances, the app, whether you knew the kid was using your credit card, whether you had notice of the period of time during which the kid could make the app purchases, all that's going to vary by plaintiff, which means you can destroy the class pretty easily. And once you've destroyed the class, nobody's going to pursue the litigation. I don't know, Jason, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right.
Okay, the last thing, and this is more this week in NSA that I wanted to talk about, is the oral argument in the Second Circuit about Section 215, and there's a couple of other topics, but this one is interesting because the ACLU got a great panel of judges, which is easier and easier these days after 6 years of Obama appointments. It sounded, it was a long argument, and it sounded as though things didn't go that well for the government. Oren, I know you went through it pretty carefully. Were you actually there, or did you listen to it on tape?
No, I watched C-SPAN. Videotaped it, and it was as good as being there. You know, they had cameras everywhere in the Second Circuit courtroom, so it was pretty cool to watch. But it was an hour and 45 minutes of back and forth.
Wow. And what's your assessment about the biggest risks to the government here and maybe the biggest risks to the ACLU?
So my guess as to what the Second Circuit's going to do, and really this is mostly from Judge Lynch, who was presiding and the most active of the questioners, is that they're going to find a way to, they're going to say that there's a private right of action or that the Administrative Procedure Act applies to, allow any private party to litigate the lawfulness of Section 215 surveillance. And then they're going to conclude that the statutory interpretation of the FISC is not a persuasive interpretation, but then stay their own ruling because lots of other courts are considering the issue. And what's kind of interesting to my mind, imagine they do that. So we'd get a statutory ruling from the Second Circuit, not a constitutional ruling.
Right.
On a question, and they would stay the ruling, so it wouldn't actually have any effect in terms of ordering the government to stop. Meanwhile, the program's going to sunset anyway, so and it would take
Supreme Court's not going to take it.
Supreme Court's not going to take it, and it would, you know, maybe it goes to rehearing in the en banc Second Circuit. So it, you know, the clock runs out pretty soon. I guess it becomes an interpretation for Congress to work with in renewing or reauthorizing or sort of changing slightly the Section 215 authority.
Yeah,
but it's not clear to me that it has any other greater significance.
Right.
You know, it's just, I almost got the sense, and maybe I'm overreading or overlistening Judge Lynch's comments at oral argument, but the Second Circuit really wanted to say that the statutory interpretation was implausible, which I think is correct, and they wanted to find a way to put that in there in a way that wouldn't maybe make much of a difference to the actual operation of the program.
Do you think they were cert-proofing this, or they genuinely were worried that they would upset a program that was important?
I'm not sure.
Right.
You know, and one interesting reference point in trying to figure out what they might do is that Judges Lynch and Sack were on the prior panel in the earlier round of Clapper litigation on Section 702, finding standing to challenge Section 702 surveillance. That opinion struck me as very much inviting the justices to resolve a circuit split between them and the Sixth Circuit, and it was very much kind of I felt in reading it, this is an amicus brief that they're filing in the Supreme Court.
So instead of cert-proofing, it was cert-prodding.
Cert-prodding, exactly. And so I wonder, you know, are they cert-prodding again? Are they trying to get the justices involved, but then it may be, given the sunset, there's nothing they can do because the clock's running out.
There's no damages claim here, then. So if they don't enjoin it, then there's nothing, right?
I guess that's right. I don't know what relief is being sought by the ACLU.
It was just an injunction.
Because if they were seeking damages, the case could go on forever.
Sure. Right?
Yes, and I assume that some law, sometime between now and June of 2015, will be passed that substitutes for the existing 215. At which point, can't the Justice Department go in and ask that the decision be either vacated or reconsidered in light of new legislation?
I would imagine.
Right? Or they go back to the district court and start over again and say, that decision has no impact because we're not construing that law anymore.
Yeah, this is a civil law question. I'm a criminal law guy, so I don't know. But it does strike me as a really interesting mix of changing legislation, changing practices, and lots of litigation happening in different circuits, and a panel that is really interested in having its impact felt a little bit, but not too much. So we'll see how it plays out.
So this is interesting. This, everybody sees the idea of adopting sunsets as a restriction on the government, a way that on the executive, a way that Congress controls things, bad for continuity of government and the like. But what's interesting is how big a crimp it puts in big litigation campaigns. Because by the time you've actually marshaled the litigation and gotten decisions or gotten a conflict in the circuits, it's time for the sunset to roll around. And then they're reauthorizing the bill with full knowledge of what the judicial interpretations have been. And it's easy to toss in a little bit of legislative history saying, yeah, we like that and not that. And that whole campaign... up in smoke.
Yeah. I mean, I think it certainly keeps it out of the Supreme Court's grasp. It really, it shifts the power to the legislature away from the judiciary.
Yeah. And in an odd way to the executive branch, which can game this, game the reauthorization, write the legislative history. It is an interesting thing.
When Obama announced the changes to the Section 215 program, I could just imagine this in a brief in opposition. Filed
yes.
at the Supreme Court, right? I'm thinking like straight from Obama, right into the brief. That program, that was changed. You know, there's no point in discussing that. You know, that's old news. Yep. This is the new news and we'd never do that again. And you know, so they control the cards in a strong way.
What was the ground for saying that it was inconsistent with the statute? Were they going off on the grounds that the P Club, or the many grounds that the P Club used? Is this about relevance, construction of relevance? What was their
statute? Yeah, construction of relevance is the primary issue. Okay. I mean, they kept sort of emphasizing that if you interpret relevance in this context to allow all phone numbers to be obtained, it could also be used all at once to obtain all credit card records. It could be used to obtain kind of any record or all records in the world, you know, and to my mind, I agree with where they were going, that this was an unpersuasive statutory interpretation, but the real rub of it, okay, is there a way of going from this is not a great interpretation to any individual can come into court and say, I get an injunction against this reading of the statute. And so that's going to be a really important holding if the court reaches that under, I gather, the Administrative Procedure Act. And maybe that gets revisited sometime.
So we talked a little bit about earlier about how the courts are over-reading Riley. And the Exhibit A for that, I think, is U.S. against Davis in the 11th Circuit and Judge Sentell's opinion saying that any information about location that you can extract from the cell tower records is somehow protected, has to have a warrant. You've been kind of critical of that, and I see that the 11th Circuit is going to take it and bank. I don't know what the lineup is in the 11th Circuit on criminal or search cases, but sort of hard to read that as anything other than them saying, you know, maybe Judge Sentell is not going to make wacky law for the 11th Circuit, or it's going to be wacky law. We're going to make it ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know how the 11th Circuit's going to play out on these issues, in part because there's a group of new Obama appointees. They don't have a record on any of these questions. So we'll see. But the decision to go en banc in the Davis case really changes the game in the circuits. And there's so much litigation on this issue that's slowly percolating its way up. There's a case in the Fourth Circuit, Graham, that's raising this issue. And Judge Sentell's panel opinion in Davis had been it was the dream opinion for the ACLU. It was really just incredibly stark. It basically took all this idea of kind of a mosaic of data eventually becoming a search and said, no, that's like the junior varsity version of the Fourth Amendment. Instead, we have this idea that we just look at certain information and say, we declare it private. And the courts announce that it is private information, even though it would traditionally be considered public information under a Fourth Amendment analysis. So that was a dramatic opinion. And the fact that that's off the books really shifts the debate, I think, considerably. Big relief for the executive branch and certainly the national security area, where that was a really dramatic opinion.
But although for law enforcement too, sorry, Stuart. I mean, you blogged on this, and I think you got it right that under the panel opinion, it's hard to imagine what kind of criminal law enforcement investigation you could actually conduct relating to electronic evidence of any form, historical, perspective, imprecise, precise, without a search warrant.
Right.
Like you need a warrant for everything, and you'd never be able to get a warrant because you wouldn't be able to use any of the building blocks that prosecutors and agents use to develop probable cause. So it could have a tremendous impact on national security, but it would cripple law enforcement.
Right. And I think as a practical matter, it removes the circuit split, which had existed with the 11th Circuit and the 5th Circuit. And it probably puts off Supreme Court review of this question by a couple of terms.
Well, that's good news, because I think that the more flowers bloom in this area, the less attractive the lawn's going to be. And my guess is that you can't have an in-bank in the 11th Circuit without somebody going back and reviving the Sentell view. It may only be three judges, but there's going to be somebody who wants to say that. And then you're going to have just this flurry of bizarre or troubling or overbroad analyses, which I think demonstrates just how risky it is to start saying, you know, the Fourth Amendment protects against whatever judges think is creepy, which is really where the ACLU is. They just want to be able to walk in and say, well, isn't this creepy too? And the earlier they can get it, the creepier it's going to seem, and the more chance they have of getting it subject to a warrant.
Yeah, and this is one area where I think the existence of a clear circuit split calls for Supreme Court review even faster than in other areas, because anyone's cell phone could obtain could give up cell site information from any state or circuit, you know, in a day. You fly from one jurisdiction to another jurisdiction, it's got data from both, and then you have the question of, okay, is the rule based on where the issue's litigated, or is it where the data's from? Presumably it's where it's litigated. Then you run into, you know, potential venue issues where the Justice Department is figuring, all right, we got to charge these cases in this district, right, and that district.
District of New Jersey does all the prosecuting.
Case law. So I think there are good reasons why the court would have to resolve any clear circuit split, and this taking this circuit split off the book really sets things back a lot.
You know, though the split, and it didn't quite reach the circuit level early on, but the split about the way that the law applies to prospective cell tower information has been growing since about 2004, 2005. That was the first magistrates' revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And it created similar issues. You'd have different judges within the same courthouse, let alone different judges in different courthouses, who would take very different views as to what the legal standard was to get prospective cell tower information. And if you had the opportunity to pursue a case in one venue and not the other, that's what you were going to do. You don't always have that freedom. But that, you know, we're almost the 10-year, 9 or 10-year anniversary of that first revolt, and that issue still hasn't been resolved. So I think we're a ways away from this one being resolved too.
So when
there's also there's also still on the books, I think, a Third Circuit decision that sort of splits the difference between the Fifth and the Eleventh Circuit panel approaches, and that court held that a magistrate has the discretion to require a warrant for cell site location data, which was a really bizarre opinion, I think, because it didn't say you had to require a warrant. You could if you wanted to, if you thought this stuff was particularly private or something for some reason, which it's hard to understand the rationale, really. But that still, it doesn't create a clear circuit split if the 11th Circuit goes with the 5th, but it still muddies the waters quite a bit.
So when are we going to hear an argument in this one?
I don't remember if they've announced a date.
Okay. So I have a bold prediction that there will be at least 3 decisions and that all of them will cite Orrin Kerr. All right. Well, thank you, Michael, Jason, Orrin. Before we sign off, we do like to give everybody a chance to talk about anything they want to plug, speeches, publications, arguments. Orrin, do you have something that you are up to? No? Okay. Jason?
I'm going to be at the International Association of Privacy Professionals Conference in San Jose next week talking about privacy issues with virtual currencies. And then closer to home in Baltimore on October 31st at a Johns Hopkins seminar on cybersecurity talking about data breaches.
And Michael?
No, nothing for me.
Okay. I've got a panel at HP Protect later this week talking about when the breach hits the fan, not my choice of topic, but a one I admire. Then I'm going out to Minneapolis and giving a couple of talks there in early October on cybersecurity. So look for that. It's the big cybersecurity conference that they put on in Minneapolis and also one in St. Paul. Thank you all for participating. Jason Weinstein, Michael Battis, Orrin Kerr. We hope you'll join us next week when Phyllis Schneck will be our guest. She is the one of the top officials on cybersecurity at the Department of Homeland Security and a serial entrepreneur prior to going into government in cybersecurity, so someone whose technical chops are not in doubt. When she joins us, we will once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.